This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. When the COVID-19 pandemic shut down Connecticut and New York earlier this year, essential workers kept the region going. The concept is not new. Whenever there's a national crisis, certain industries have been identified as essential. Now, to help us better understand the critical role that essential workers have played in the past, we've asked Dr. Jennifer Klein of Yale University to join us. Professor Klein teaches 20th century U.S. history at Yale and is here via Skype. Professor, welcome to The Full Story.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Describing as essential certainly implies that a person is very, very important. And I wonder if that's always been the case.
Well, I have to connect it, I think, to who we see as a worker and who we don't see as a worker. Work that's hidden and work that is visible and valorized. Mm. And so if we go back to crises, say, around wartime, for example, World War I, the work that is seen and as visible as keeping both the economy going and keeping the war effort and that that heightened crisis moment going is coal mining, steel, iron, lumber, transportation. And so that's seen, and I think it's easy to grasp it as essential because we've got to have ships, we've got to have railroad. But there's also the labor that we don't see. So the people who were working in the fields and picking the food and packing the food, the people who were working in the textile plants, which are going to ultimately become uniforms and blankets for troops, and the people who are working in domestic settings, that labor was certainly as vital to the war effort, to taking care of people, to getting people through the crisis, but it's not seen. It was done by women. It was done by Blacks. It was done by immigrants. And so it was easily pushed to the margins and not qualified as essential labor, even though you certainly need food as much as you need lumber.
So in that case, the one you describe of around World War I, it was not necessarily the type of work being done, but the people who were doing it that became a defining factor of essential worker.
I think that's a really good point because who is the worker, especially when the worker is stigmatized and is denied rights, gets associated with what kind of labor is valued and what kind of labor is seen as absolutely essential to keeping our society going. The other thing that I think affects the way that people, are able to function economically and socially during crises, during wartime emergencies, is whether the wartime would become an opportunity for improved labor standards and rising wages, or for the very opposite, for longer days, for insecurity, for wages that are not paid. And so in both the crises of World War I and in World War II, the interesting thing is that you had the role of unions that really could step in and use the tight labor markets to push gains for workers, to use the strike and to use these other tools to really push up wages and gain greater compensation and therefore recognition for workers. And the other thing that you had was an active government that was willing to step in because it was a crisis and say, look, the bottom line here is we can't have a strike in lumber. We cannot have coal miners on strike. We can't even have field workers on strike. We're going to have a labor board that's going to resolve these labor conflicts, that's going to keep this essential work going. And in that way, workers were actually able to gain some rights. So you have a government that's willing to also recognize this is essential work, and we're not going to get through this crisis unless we put some support there so that workers don't get disgruntled, don't get frustrated, and walk out on strike. And so that, I think, makes a big difference. The thing is what happens when the crisis passes? So in 1919, after the war was over, that big push, the production effort, of course, you get the flu pandemic coming in, but employers wanted to say, okay, those gains were just, you know, you might have been like essential and you might have had some leverage during the war, but that's over. And they were prepared to roll it back and were able to bring in actually violence and the state militia and repression to push back those gains. And so that's why then you have a next round where in the New Deal, workers gain more permanent rights. And moving into World War II, again, you have a new phase of saying, we need all hands on deck. What is going to be essential work, and how are we going to recognize it?
We're talking with Professor Jennifer Klein of Yale University about the history of essential workers. Professor Klein, I'd like to shift gears just a little bit here and talk about, as opposed to a war crisis, a pandemic crisis like the one we're dealing with right now. Would that change the definition of who's an essential worker? In this case, as far as COVID-19 goes, we've talked about, we've seen everyone from grocery store workers to healthcare workers, all sorts of people that we see every day in normal, quote unquote, normal times, now defined as essential workers. Is this kind of a crisis different than a wartime crisis when it comes to an essential worker?
I think so, in that, again, there's at least, you know, during World War One and World War Two, there was, a really strong role for unions and for the government to work together to say, all right, if you're going to expect this all out production for the war effort, then what is now seen as essential labor has to be better compensated. I think if we go back to an earlier period, in the 20th century, where nurses are doing a lot of the frontline labor, and even domestic workers in the home, laundry workers, at the time, the workers, again, these women, although they had their own means of organizing, their labors were so devalued as being the labors of women, of servants, of African Americans, that they're seen as being on the margins. And so, yes, these women do a tremendous job during the pandemic, especially in getting people to wear masks. It's pretty amazing when you see how many people were wearing masks in that earlier period.
100 years ago,
but
yeah.
When the New Deal comes along and for the first time enacts labor standards, for example, the National Labor Relations Act regarding unionism, the Fair Labor Standards Act for the minimum wage and the 40-hour work week, and even the Social Security Act, those jobs that women did, especially in what was considered the charitable sector or the nonprofit sector or government, those were completely excluded. Those were not included. So they were not really seen as real workers. Domestic workers who were mostly African American women were left out of the new rights that would enfranchise a citizen worker as a result of the New Deal. So even though they're there doing the critical work that keeps people alive, their jobs were specifically cut out of the labor standards that would be created in order to recognize the value of labor and what should be the rewards of labor. And so then that becomes the struggle over the rest of the 20th century, is to get that kind of gendered and racialized labor that was done by women and by African Americans and by Mexicans who worked in agriculture and in food packing included in our codification of real work that's under labor standards.
Professor Klein, thanks for taking time to shed some light on the history of essential workers for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Klein of Yale University is a professor of 20th century U.S. history. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security defines essential workers as, quote, those who conduct a range of operations and services that are identified as essential to keep critical infrastructure operating. But critical infrastructure is a rather broad term, and often the states decide which jobs fall into that category. Let's try to define essential worker in our region. And as we do that, are we redefining the value of work that we agree is essential during a crisis? Joining me now is Roger Sincerek via Skype. He is the communications director of the Working Families Organization in Connecticut. It's an independent political group that advocates for working families. Mr. Sincerek, hello and welcome to The Full Story.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Can you tell me, has Connecticut, to your knowledge, clearly defined who essential workers are and what they do?
Yes. The governor in his executive order gave a good definition of what essential work entailed. And it included people that do essential work repairing buildings and facilities, to people that work in pharmacies, people that work in the healthcare industry. So we had a fairly good definition on what essential was and what workers needed to keep going at work during the days of the lockdown in March, April this year.
And where on the economic scale do these essential jobs register primarily?
So primarily, it has been jobs that are mostly fairly low income and mostly occupied by people of color, Latino and African American, essentially. They are jobs that are highly visible. We interact with them all the time. Clerks that work at supermarkets, people that actually clean buildings, people that actually repair facilities, that have been asked to keep going to work even when actually there were real health hazards for just interacting with people and just being outside meeting with people and delivering those services that we rely on. But they are background noise for most of us because we actually don't pay much attention to our workers in a regular day.
It sounds like then generally the working class is taking on the lion's share of the burden of keeping our economy going while at the same time putting their health at risk.
Yes, and that has been a big issue for us, and it has been a big issue for many people that have been involved with workers' rights for the past few months. A lot of companies have provided hazard pay and have provided additional pay essentially for workers that had to be the front lines, working at grocery stores, working at pharmacies, but not all of them. We actually conducted a survey online for people that were deemed essential, that were still working. And a majority of workers in our state were not even getting any additional pay while they were working on the front lines. So we had this vast army of workers that were doing the kind of jobs that we needed for not just keeping the economy going, but actually keeping us supplied, stocking the shelves, allowing everyone else to actually be able to shop and be able to get what they needed to stay at home, that were not getting extra pay. And they were still having regular schedules. They were actually having very uncertain time knowing if they were going to get sick days at all, if they could take days off because they had symptoms, if they going to get paid, if they had to stay at home because a co-worker that they interacted with had to quarantine because he or she had to get tested. So yes, it has been mostly the working class that faced the burden of this, and they faced it with the additional uncertainty of not knowing how to react to this illness and sometimes not even getting the same amount of hours of work that they were getting before, because a lot of the stores were having shorter hours, and to top it off, without getting much additional pay, if any at all.
Well, are there any official descriptions of the type of compensation, the dollar amounts, and other things that essential workers are entitled to for being required to work during a public crisis like a pandemic?
No, and that was one of the big issues that we had during work. So the companies that were offering hazard pay were doing them on their own volition. They were usually either companies that were large chains or workplaces that were unionized, and the unions managed to exert some pressure to ask for that additional funding. But other than that, essential workers had to go to work and had to negotiate with their employer, if possible, if they could get additional funds. But they, most of the time, they did not, for what we were hearing and what we saw in most of those positions.
Well, then, how would you say essential workers be compensated financially? Benefits, healthcare benefits, that sort of thing, perhaps other benefits?
So Congress, actually House of Representatives, tried to pass legislation to establish by law that essential workers during a health emergency were entitled for time and a half wages, and expanding and clarifying a bit the limited paid leave policies that were incorporated in the first stimulus package, in the first bunch of funding and the additional employment benefits and all that Congress passed back in March, April. That got stuck in the Senate, and it's not likely that it's going to pass before the presidential election, if at all. So we strongly believe that it should be additional pay. It should be time and a half. It should be with very clear mandates for employers to actually supply proper personal protective equipment for workers that are actually interacting with the public. It should actually establish sick days and compensation compensation for workers that actually fall sick or that they have to stop working because someone at their workplace was raised to have a contact. But legally, it's not there. As much as Governor Lamont was able to actually establish practices to mandate, for instance, the one-way aisles in the supermarkets and having to wear a mask and all that, the additional pay for essential workers, it's not something that it's written in law.
We're speaking with Roger Sincerek, the communications director of the Working Families Organization in Connecticut. Mr. Sincerek, we spoke with a labor historian from Yale for this program, Professor Jennifer Klein, and she pointed out that during World War I, essential workers were often valued by who they were rather than the work that they were doing. Do you think that's changed since then, or is that still true today?
I mean, if we look at the numbers and we look who's doing that work and how much they are getting paid, I cannot say that we have been valuing essential workers that much. They are mostly workers of color. They are mostly workers that have very erratic schedules, that they sometimes work close to, like, completely at will from their employers. So basically, they have to call the night before to know if they are going to get a shift at all, for instance. Yes, we call them essential, but we don't treat them as such, and we don't value them as such. So it's hard to say how much we are valuing them. We are calling their positions essential, and we are asking them to put themselves at risk in ways that a lot of us office workers don't have to, other than when we do our supply run at the supermarket a couple of times a week, if that. But we are not paying them, and we are not offering the benefits or the healthcare coverage or the paid sick time that they need to actually, you know, live up to the name of essential that we are giving them.
And what are you hearing from these workers, these people who work essential jobs? What do they want from lawmakers and business leaders?
They want what every worker wants. They actually want good pay and good benefits. They actually want to make sure that lawmakers understand that they didn't sign up to be at risk at work. You know, you're starting to work in a big box store. You're not signing up to serve in the military. It's not the same kind of risk. But we are asking them to actually take a risk that a lot of us are not. So as much as they appreciate like the signs, they appreciate the yard signs, they appreciate the nice commercials from Walmart and from the big chains. They actually want to be able to be represented at their workplace. They actually want to be able to know that they are going to have a job, even if they have to take a few days off to take care of their kids because their kids' school got closed. Essentially, have the stability that we all crave, like the good employment and good jobs that we all need to be able to thrive and take care of our families.
Mr. Sincerek, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Roger Sincerek is the communications director of the Working Families Organization in Connecticut. A new report by the United Way shows that for more than a decade, working poor families in Connecticut have been struggling with stagnating wages, while the cost for their basic needs have gone up. And this was before the pandemic. We're going to dig into this report with help from Stephanie Hoops. She's the director of the United Way Alice Project. Ms. Hoops, hello. Thanks for joining us on The Full Story.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you today, Tom.
Could you explain for us what is the ALICE Project? It's an acronym, I understand.
Well, ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. So families that we all know in our communities, many of us have been ALICE, who are working hard, low-wage jobs, struggling paycheck to paycheck, and have little or no savings to get them through an emergency.
But they are technically living above the federal poverty level?
Exactly. So the current understanding of financial hardship is through the federal poverty level, which was developed 50 years ago in response to Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. But now, fast forward, the world has changed, our budget has changed, and the cost of living has significantly increased. And it varies across the country. The federal poverty level is not very helpful to us in understanding who is actually struggling. So ALICE is a new measure that looks at the cost of living in each county, in each state in the country, and then how many people fall below that. And what we find is that there's a large number that earn above that federal poverty level, but below the cost of basic needs where they live. And so the technical version of ALICE is earning above the federal poverty level, but below ALICE threshold based on a survival budget.
And as you mentioned, the report found that the cost of basic goods increased, and increased, as I understand it, faster than other expenses in Connecticut between 2007 and 2018. But again, hourly wages did not keep pace. What kind of impact does this have on a typical ALICE household?
Great question. And it's one of the reasons we're seeing so much struggle right now during the pandemic is that while wages have been flat or in some cases have increased a little bit, they have not increased as fast as the basic goods that ALICE families buy on a regular basis. And that would be just your basic low-income housing, childcare, food, transportation, healthcare, and a smartphone plan. We measure the change in those costs with a new measure called the ALICE Essentials Index. And if you could think of it as a companion to the more common rate of inflation tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index. And that measures all the goods and services that people of all incomes buy on a regular basis. And so over the last decade, that's been increasing at about 1.7, 1.8% a year, whereas the ALICE Essentials Index has been increasing almost twice that, over 3% a year. And that helps explain why folks at the low end are struggling more, and yet the economy overall seems to be doing well.
Now, childcare, when speaking of essentials, childcare is a need that many ALICE families need to access, but it takes up a lot of their resources, and it's getting harder to find. What's changed as far as getting access to good childcare?
So childcare is a huge challenge for Alice families. If you have two children, even in family childcare, which is not as expensive as a licensed accredited center, childcare can be the largest item in your budget. It can be more than housing. So if both parents need to work, you have a big expense. And that's on the family side. On the childcare center side, they've been really struggling before the pandemic hit, as rents increased and subsidies for childcare slots have not kept pace. Some childcare centers were on the brink of closing. Some had already closed. And then the pandemic, lots of people pulled their children out of childcare as their work stopped, and others were forced to reduce the number of children that they could take on, you know, for the pandemic health and safety reasons. So childcare centers' ability to have a viable business model was really hit by the pandemic and especially the economic slowdown associated with that. And as we want our economy to come back and parents want to get back to work, we have a bottleneck here around childcare centers.
And what about technology? These days, that's a basic need, too, that the report addresses. And it's been made even more essential during the pandemic. But I understand the report was compiled before COVID-19. What access did poor working families have to technology before the pandemic, before 2020?
Right. The pandemic has certainly put technology in a new light. So in the basic ALICE budget, we have included the cost of a smartphone plan because our criteria for the budget is what's the bare minimum that you need to live and work in the modern economy. And so being able to access your cell phone has become important to work in terms of getting your schedule, reporting to work, accessing information about clients or patients. So it made sense to add that. Now, in light of the pandemic, it seems that broadband access at home is also being essential if you want to be able to work from home. And then we're seeing all the additional needs in terms of children learning from home as well. We know and report in the report that ALICE families are much less likely to have access to broadband and digital devices. So this does put them in a disadvantage now as the world has changed and those things are more important for working, learning, and just communicating.
According to the report, the number of minority households on the ALICE list grew by 11% during that same window between 2007 and 2018, while white households decreased by 10%. What's behind these shifts?
So these are not surprising findings. We know that there are ALICE households in all race and ethnic groups, but certainly some face additional barriers to jobs with higher wages and to other supports that help the well-being of your household. And so Black and Hispanic households especially face higher unemployment rates, lower wages. They're more likely to work in hourly paid jobs, which have fluctuating schedules and are less likely to have benefits. And so these barriers combine to reduce income that then limits your ability to save and build assets over time. So we see a racial gap in Connecticut, as in all states across the country, that is growing. It's growing over the last decade, and the pandemic is exacerbating that.
We talked about the federal poverty level, and the ALICE report does say, as you pointed out, it needs to be reassessed because it's too low. What should the federal poverty level be?
Well, we would vote very strongly that it should be the ALICE threshold because the cost of living varies across states, even within states, as do wages. And it's where there's that mismatch that you have financial hardship. And so the current federal poverty level is the same number across the country, does not take into account any regional variation. So we would argue that a measure that's based on the actual cost of living and that takes into account differences in different parts of the country is something that would be more realistic and very helpful to policymakers in trying to target dollars, formulate policy, and for communities to come up with better solutions.
Another thing that the report recommends is that Connecticut lawmakers increase wages for ALICE households, because in addition to lifting the personal economy of working families, it will improve the overall economy of the state. How so?
So we have a terrific graphic at the end of the report, and it looks at what would be the impact on the whole economy if all households had income up to that ALICE threshold. So it would mean additional earnings. And we know folks at the lower end of the income scale, when they get additional income, they spend it, and that goes right back into the economy and has a multiplier effect. If folks had more earnings, they would also pay more taxes, and the government would have more money to do the things that it can do. And that could be anything from tax cuts to increased spending on infrastructure. That has an economic multiplier as well. And then when folks have more income, they don't need the same kind of public assistance that they would otherwise. And communities become healthier, safer. And so together, we estimate that the impact on the Connecticut economy would be a $42 billion a year increase to GDP in Connecticut. So this is a way to have economic growth, to share prosperity. And it's meant to be an exercise to encourage folks to think about the positive aspect of doing this. The converse, unfortunately, is practically what we're doing right now with the pandemic, where people's earnings have been cut back, tax revenues being cut back, and we're seeing the kind of spiral down impact on a state economy. And Connecticut is certainly not unique in this. Every state in the country is facing this right now. But it's very mindful that there are so many ALICE households, their fate is linked to the overall economy. And so if their prospects improve, so does the whole economy.
I'm sure businesses, especially during the pandemic, would say that increasing wages, as you pointed out, not only is it nearly impossible, the opposite has been happening. Does the picture that you paint of an economy during, quote-unquote, normal times, is that a picture that's strong enough, do you think, to convince business owners, especially small businesses, that higher wages are a good thing?
Well, we're not the first to think of this. And in fact, one of my favorite examples is Henry Ford, 100 years ago, decided to pay his workers enough so they could buy cars. And I think it's a really important thing to remember that most businesses need customers. And so if folks are barely scrambling to meet their basic needs, they're not very good customers outside of that. So to have a prosperous economy, a growing economy, families need to earn enough to support themselves and to be able to participate in that economy and help, you know, new products to grow and innovation to happen.
Ms. Hoops, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Terrific to talk to you. Thank you.
Stephanie Hoops is the director of the United Way ALICE Project. Today, we're taking a closer look at what it means to be an essential worker. And if the pandemic is changing the value we place on jobs and people that were vital during the shutdown earlier this year, we've invited the president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO, Sal Luciano, to weigh in on those questions. Mr. Luciano, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. How many of your members are now essential workers?
So essential workers used to be considered firefighters, EMT, police, corrections officers, and that's still all true. But the pandemic has made some interesting groups of people essential as well. We fought to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, and many people felt that people were not deserving of the raise in the minimum wage. But if you look at the people who are deemed essential during this pandemic, they're the people who work in the nursing homes. They're bus drivers and transport workers. They're grocery store people. They're fast food workers, all considered to be essential. And interestingly enough, many of those people in those jobs are minorities. And so the pandemic has not only changed the idea of who's essential, but it also has laid bare some of the problems of racism. Many of these people who work these jobs, they're majority minority, and so it's made life a little bit interesting. If we look at the people who have caught the COVID virus, if you're white, you most likely caught it in a convalescent home. If you're black or brown, you most likely caught it at work, and in many cases, at work taking care of white people in convalescent homes.
And I'm guessing that most of them didn't have frontline worker in their job descriptions.
Yes, many of them did not expect to have to be dealing with this pandemic in their job description, exactly.
And what are they telling you about that sort of change in the nature of what they have to do and about what they need to continue working during the pandemic, because it's not over, as we all know.
Correct. And so it isn't only the fact that they put their lives and their families' lives in danger in terms of something they didn't sign up for. If you add to that the fact that the enforcement on, you know, when people don't wear masks in a grocery store, it falls on the grocery worker to kind of enforce that.
And, yeah, you're
and so
talking
that's
about
caused problems as well.
You mean you're talking about customers who don't wear masks?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's caused some friction and some problems as well. So the conditions are much, much different. And I think, you know, there's no argument now that these people are worth what they're paid. In fact, the HEROES Act that was passed by Congress probably 4 or 5 months ago that sat on the Senate desk actually had a differential, what they called HEROES pay, to recognize these workers.
Are workers, from what you hear, are workers getting what they need, these workers getting what they need to stay safe on their jobs?
Initially, the answer was not anywhere near. Bus drivers were making change. The front doors were open. People didn't really know what was going on. And when they did and they realized how essential masks and personal protective equipment were, you couldn't find it. In a total lack of preparation, the federal government had no reserves. In one situation, actually probably more than one situation, but in one situation that I know of, Connecticut and the federal government, the state of Connecticut and the federal government, were both vying for the same set of personal protective equipment. In a real crazy situation, the feds were actually competing with the states for personal protective equipment. And even now, months later, many nurses are not having enough PPE. They're using it 5-6 days in a row, which is not acceptable under any kind of normal situations. Under the emergency situations, yes, but we're 6-7 months into it and we're still under emergency situations.
Is there some specific action that you and your members would like to see from either state or federal government at this point, or both?
I think the pandemic has really push the curtain back on some of the structural racism problems in Connecticut. And so I think it would be helpful to look at that in an overall picture. Over 3/4 of white people own their own homes. Less than half of minority people own their own homes. If you look at many of the jobs that were essential were done by black and brown people, there were also many jobs, especially in the restaurant and hospitality industry, that were done by black and brown people that vanished. 6 weeks into the pandemic, 40% of all jobs, $40,000 or less, disappeared. And again, many of those jobs were majority minority. Not everybody has shared the pain during the pandemic. During those same 6 weeks, billionaires made $262 billion. Throwing back the curtain on the wealth disparity in this country.
We're speaking with Sal Luciano, the president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO. Mr. Luciano, I'd like to ask you something more specific about unions and unions during the pandemic, more specifically. On your website, you have a recent press release about a Gallup poll that shows public approval for unions is at its highest level in, I think, 17 years, even Republicans giving more support. How do you account for that change?
I think there's a real understanding of the imbalance of wealth in this country. And I think if you don't have a union, you really have no voice. If, you know, the old saying, if you don't like it, leave. With a union, you have the ability to collectively bargain. And, you know, ironically, even though you make more money, that's not the number one reason workers join a union. Workers join a union to have to be able to feel safer and put in safety in working conditions. And that's the primary reason people unionize. And I think because of the disparity and the ever-growing realization of the wealth disparity, I think the change in the mood of the country is maybe people who work and sweat and bleed for a living, maybe they need to be looked at too. If you're a working person in Connecticut, about a quarter of everything you earn goes into taxes, state taxes, local taxes, property taxes. If you're a multimillionaire, you're not paying 6% in taxes. And so I'm not saying soak the rich. I'm really saying there's a realization that we need to stop soaking the middle class and working people.
What about the relationships between unions and business leaders? Do you think those relationships have changed due to the pandemic?
I think they have a little bit. I think we're in the same boat in many cases, even though often it's the workers who are putting their lives on the line and the managers who are able to shelter in place. But, you know, like other countries have union members on their boards. They have union members on the front line who are able to better able to talk about the things that the customers are dealing with. And so there, I think, is a growing appreciation that there's value in listening to the frontline worker.
I'm curious, too, about how you do your work. Has the pandemic changed what you do or how you do it?
Yes, I socially distance. The office has less people in it mm-hmm. at any one time. But we continue to do the things that we need to do, whether that was protest on Monday, Amazon's use of Amazon bringing in a company that did not provide workers' compensation for workers that they're bringing in from all over the country. While we're doing a good job making sure that COVID is contained and at around 1%, companies like Amazon and arguably the richest person in the world, Jeff Bezos, is bringing in companies that not only don't provide workers' compensation for the workers, but are also bringing them from all over the country without quarantining them. And so those things are still happening, and so we still point those things out.
So the basic issues that you advocate for, that the union advocates for, are still pretty much the same, you would say, but perhaps more focused due to the pandemic?
Yes, and I think the pandemic also showed the disparity between working people and the very wealthy. And so it's also an opportunity to continue to push and advocate for people who work for a living.
In some unions, we've heard that not too long ago the memberships had dipped to all-time lows and public support had gone down. Although we did talk about the Gallup poll that shows an increasing level of support from the public. I'm wondering, do you think once the pandemic has at least backed off a bit or perhaps ended at some point, will people forget and then the decline in union membership and support will resume?
That's a good question. But I think that now that people are aware of the wealth disparity, now that they're aware of the fact that even while workers are, you know, many workers, especially the ALIS people, the people that are one flat tire, these people, they tend to be unemployed because they have such little money that they can't really overcome small hardships like a flat tire, like a child being sick and like not being able to pay for daycare. And so when they miss work for these valid reasons, they're often unemployed. And I think people are starting to recognize the struggle of these people. In Hartford, the median income is under $18,000 a year. So, you know, when you look at how can we help these people, well, you can't. If they're making such little money that they have housing insecurity, food insecurity, 24 hours a day. And so I think the realization that we need to do something about that, I think will make unions stronger. And I think there was a real push when people understood when we tried to raise the minimum wage. Yet there were many conservatives who were against it, but there were many common sense conservatives who said, yeah, I mean, $15 isn't even a living wage. We should raise it to 15 and maybe even higher. And so those kinds of approval ratings show that people as in society are starting to look at working people and seeing them more as an asset.
Mr. Luciano, thanks so much for giving us the union perspective on essential workers. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Sal Luciano was the president of the Connecticut AFL-CIO. Are you an essential worker? Tell us about how you do your job during the pandemic. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. And that's it for our show today. It's produced by Fatou Sangari and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.